Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, and we have on Tim Matthews to discuss the 1980 adaptation of The Shining. It is one of the best horror movies, in my opinion, and while it doesn't totally adapt everything in the book, it does have its own spin on things. So, you know, it's just one of those things where you can enjoy an adaptation, even though it isn't exactly like the book that came before it. But Tim, are you ready to talk about The Shining today?
Oh, absolutely.
It was weird sort of rewatching this because I had rewatched it relatively recently, maybe last year or earlier this year. And I had seen bits and pieces of the movie over the years until I first sat down and watched it all the way through, I think, like I said, last year or earlier this year. But I had read the book quite a while ago. I read that in college before I really started diving into everything Stephen King related. It was one of those things where, you know, we had a bunch of the books at the house, but I ended up reading this on like a PDF on my iPad or something like that, or on my laptop maybe even. And while that isn't the greatest reading experience, the book just really stuck with me, and I knew that the movie was something that people just continually talked about every time, you know, the genre of horror was brought up and you have Jack Nicholson in this iconic role. So why don't we go ahead and start off with just a quick discussion on the casting, because I think that is a big part, especially Jack Nicholson's role, that just makes this movie what it is. So, you know, you have Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance. You have Shelley Duvall as Wendy Torrance. You have Danny Lloyd as Danny. Ironically, two out of three of these actors had the same first names as their characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of just funny to think about. You have Scatman Crothers as Dick Halloran. And you sort of just have these other characters who pop in and out. But for the most part, those are the four you're really seeing more of than anyone else.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a terrific cast. I know the one thing that I think Stephen King himself has always pointed out about the casting is that the tough thing with Jack Nicholson is that you're so used to, even by this time in his career, you're so used to him being the guy who can go crazy. And I can understand for some people, it may make it difficult for them to see the slow burn of someone, you know, dripping into madness the way that he does. But I think watching it today, because I watched it, I revisited it in October, and then, you know, rewatching it again today, had no quarrels with having to watch it again. I love this movie, and I definitely think I think he pulls off the slow burn pretty well, and it's almost like his slight craziness is just like a bit of his charm, like even with Shelley, like they all play off together very well. The subtlety in Scatman's performance with Dick Halloran, I think, is one of the shining. I didn't mean to say that. One of the shining roles in the film that he's not in a ton of it, but I think he plays a huge role and really makes an impact every time he's on screen. And the kid was great too, because that can always be iffy with child actors, but I thought he did a really good job.
Yeah, I think of the four main ones we're talking about right now, you know, Shelley Duvall's performance of Wendy was a little over the top at times.
It's interesting.
Yeah, because that's one of the issues that Stephen King had with this adaptation, was how they portrayed Wendy in it. And yeah, I definitely can see where he's coming from with that, because he writes some of these characters in a pretty different way, you know. And I do agree with you that Danny Lloyd did a great job as Danny. And like you said, with child actors, you never really know what you're going to get. It's very hit or miss. And I think, you know, even though I'm pretty sure this is really the only thing he's known for still today, it's one of those things where it was such an iconic performance of the character, even with the differences between the movie and the book, that it just stuck with people. And obviously the same when you have Jack Nicholson in some of these sort of crazier roles. You know, he was the Joker. He was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I think those two and this performance in The Shining, those are some of his, you know, three craziest performances, maybe. I mean,
oh yeah,
obviously you can debate that, but off the top of my head, those are like the three things I immediately go to when you say Jack Nicholson, other than Lakers, because he's just at all the Lakers games pretty much. But that's for a different reason. And it is a slow burn. And I think, you know, we'll move on a little here to some more of the story, but the pacing of this movie, it's fairly long. It's about 2 hours and 20 minutes, give or take a few minutes there. And yeah, you have these characters in a somewhat confined space. Obviously, the hotel is huge, so we do get a lot of different places that we see within the hotel and even just outside on the grounds and everything. But you have these people, and Jack has been warned about getting cabin fever and everything like that, and what happened back in the day, you know,
yeah,
I believe Grady, in like 1970 or so, with Grady and him killing his entire family, which, you know, the twins aren't in the book. And that's something I seem to always forget, because that's another thing that has just stood out so much with this movie, that
it's so iconic.
Yeah, I think I even misspoke when I was discussing the book, because I thought they were in it too. And I was like, oh, wait, that's just the movie. And, you yeah, know, the movie has had such an impact on the story that it kind of blurs what actually happened in the book at times. But you have Jack going in for the interview, so we see him before he even has the job. And then you have them getting there on closing day, so everything is sort of being taken care of, all this last minute stuff coming in and out, making sure they're stocked up on food for months on end, since it's not like there's a grocery store down the street they can go to or anything like that.
Right.
And you have a handful of characters left at the hotel. You know, you have Ullman, who Jack had the interview with, and then you have Halloran, who is the head chef, and he's showing Wendy around the kitchen, giving Danny ice cream and things like that. And that's when you really first make that connection with Danny and Halloran.
Yeah.
But then you jump to a month later, which I think is a smart move, because I feel like we might have been pretty bored just seeing them sort of settling in. A month in, it's like, okay, they sort of know where everything is. They're probably not really getting lost quite as much in the hotel, which Wendy makes a comment about when they first get there, you know, that it's yeah, so big she can get lost in there and we'll have to leave breadcrumbs and everything along the way. So, you know, that time jump there, I think that was a smart move, because we know they're going to be there for several months, or they're supposed to be at least.
Exactly. And we get enough after the time jump of them being relatively normal, you know, maybe a weird thing here happens there,
right,
you know, or whatever, but we get enough of that even after the time jump that it's not like they do the time jump and then all of a sudden crazy shit's happening. They still pace everything out really well. And like, one of the things I really like, especially done a lot through the first half of the film, when they might be in a giant room and having like a full conversation, and it never cuts to a close up. It's a very far away shot. And I really like how it helps to really express the isolation that this hotel is. It's this giant place in the middle of nowhere. No one's there. And even within this hotel, it's so massive and isolated with just, you know, the three of them there, or so they think. And I really, really enjoyed the variety of those shots. And it makes when he does go in for the close-ups to really have an impact on getting the emotion and reaction from the characters.
We get a lot of those faraway shots too when Jack is just sitting at the giant desk using his typewriter and stuff. You know, we see it from different angles as well. You have some shots from behind and some shots from, you know, coming in through the other way to where you'd be facing him. And it's one of those things where, you know, the cinematography on this is fantastic. You have that shot too. And obviously we could probably talk about the cinematography for a while, but I just want to make note of some other shots here. And there's one when Jack is in the food storage room and Wendy has locked him in, and it's just sort of looking up at him sort of pounding on the door and everything. And it's just such a powerful image. And then obviously you have the close up when he has his "Here's Johnny" moment. And it's just things like that, knowing when to give such a good look at the character, or when to sort of, like you said, have that view where you're further away from them and you can sort of just get a feel for the entire room instead of just what these characters are going through.
Absolutely. Yeah, that shot of him in the pantry, and you just get his madness in full form. You know, you get his anger of trying to get out, but then you also get you watch these little, in these ways that only Jack Nicholson can do, you watch these little ticks where he switches to realizes, okay, the angry isn't going to get me out of here. But then it's like starts the pleading. Oh, you hurt my head real bad. I need a doctor. And then you even see that slide right back in to when that's not working. It slides right back into like, I'm going to murder her. It's done so well. Another one of the shots I'd like to shout out for the cinematography is, it's done multiple times, but it's when Danny's riding his big wheel.
Yeah.
And the way the camera just follows him. And I love how each time he's riding in his big wheel, like the first time, like nothing really happens out of it. And then the second time they do it, he has, you know, an encounter with like the twins, and then a little bit more, so that, you know, it's like when, and then he gets a hint of room 237. So it's done so brilliantly to build that tension of, oh, he's going around this corner. Is something going to be there? Is something going to be there? And then nothing's there. And so then the next time it happens, you're like, well, nothing happened before, but something's got to happen this time. And then nothing happens. Nothing happens. And then boom, there it is. And the tension is done so well. The way he builds horror in this film is just terrific. And it's done in such a classic way. And I personally think it's still really, you know, some old films, like, you know, it was probably scary at the time, but it doesn't necessarily feel as scary now, but you can still imagine it at that time. This one, I think it still holds up for the most part in terms of how it builds its terror. I think if someone were to watch it fresh now, they would still be freaked out about it, or unnerved at least.
Exactly. I really like that you brought up the shots of Danny riding his bike, because it's almost like you're on a big wheel behind him and just following him. So you're seeing it from sort of this kid's perspective as well, because it's, you know, like roughly at the same height that he is when he's riding the bike and everything like that. But, you know, we can't really talk about the cinematography without talking about that opening establishing shot of the Overlook either, because I think, you know, that might be one of my favorite opening establishing shots just in film in general, because you have this long sort of desolate road, because only people who are going to the Overlook pretty much take this road. And when Jack goes for the interview, obviously guests are already there. So it's just, you know, this one car on this sort of windy road, and it's going up, and then you get the big view of the hotel and everything. And we do see that again later too, when they are actually moving there and getting there on closing day. But just to open with that have the credits rolling over it, you know, because back then they did credits first and sort of gave you the names first and everything like that, whereas most movies do not do that today. But it was just one of those shots where you're like, oh, wow, okay, they're really out in the middle of nowhere, pretty much.
Yeah, it that was when I rewatched it last month, because I had kind of forgotten how it opened. I only had a vague memory of it. And when the credits just start, simply just scrolling up, I was just kind of like, oh, well, this this is interesting. Like, it's I'm so used to things that are kind of, it maybe it like pops up on the screen and then fades away, or it's a little fancy or something. And I'm like, no, it's just a simple scroll. And that's all you need, because it's doing that, but your focus is all on that road. Your focus is on that car and everything beyond the road, and just, fascinated with, it just keeps going and going. And where is this going? And the music that's playing behind it is so fantastic. And I mean, that theme is iconic in itself. And I've heard it talked about. I've done a little reading on it, and I've also heard it talked about on some other podcasts that focus on music, that the notes used are inspired and built off of a Gregorian chant known as Dies Irae.
Okay.
And it's kind of one of the shows that I think did it really well was a one called The Soundtrack Show. He does a real deep dive into the composition of everything, and these notes are used in so many films, including even like Lord of the Rings. But basically these notes, it's kind of gained a reputation of a foreboding tone and death. And it's almost become like the death theme. And so many films take these notes and will, move them in a bit of variation to gain that impact at the right moment in their film. So for this one to just open with that sense of dread to begin with, you know this road is only taking them to absolute terror in the end. And it's cool to know a bit of that backstory, to that kind of sets the film up in a really interesting way. And I feel like it does it even subconsciously, even without knowing that information.
Since that road leads right to the hotel, I actually think this is a good place to talk about the hotel as a character. We've seen this in plenty of movies or TV shows where this inanimate object really ends up feeling like a character. And, I read that Stephen King was inspired quite a bit by The Haunting of Hill House. And while the recent Netflix show is drastically different from the actual book, it still keeps that core about the house. The house really feels mm-hmm. like a character in that, and it really influences all of the other characters. And we see that here with the Overlook. So I think, that was a very nice nod to Shirley Jackson and what she did, because, it's the Overlook that is making Jack the way that he is. Sure, he already had a temper, but he had stopped drinking and actually seemed like he was getting back to normal for a bit there. And then you sort of just see him slowly turn. And even though we don't see what happens in that first month, you sort of see his anger coming back and shining through, no pun intended. We've both done that, so I guess we're even here.
See how many more we get in.
We'll have to keep score here.
Yeah.
But it's just one of those things where the cabin fever certainly does apply. And obviously, when you hear the story about Grady, you're like, okay, there is something about this place. And then as Danny starts seeing all of the ghosts, which we will talk about all of those in a moment, because it doesn't end up just being Danny who sees them. So, this hotel has a power over people. And while it doesn't affect Wendy really, because of Danny's abilities and because of Jack's anger, it sort of grabs onto them more, and Danny is just strong enough to not let it get to him, basically. But I do really like the fact that the hotel plays that sort of role in this.
Absolutely. And a couple of the things I noted during it were a few lines early on. Wendy says to Jack, she says, when I first came up here, I was a little scared. And Jack's response is that he fell in love with it right away. It was like I've always been here.
Right.
And then that's even echoed when, you know, we'll get more into the ghosts later, but he does have an interaction with Grady, and Grady's line is, "You are the caretaker. You've always been the caretaker. Right. I should know. I've always been here." And it's this theme that's built throughout it, that it's and even when Jack is at the interview and it cuts to Danny, you know, talking to Tony in the mirror and saying, "Do you think he's getting the job?" And, you know, he says he already did. And it's just it's as if this place has drawn him there, that there's something that called to him, because this house wants him. This house wants to swallow him up and use him to get the other two. And Danny having the shining probably has something to do with that as well. Because Grady, you know, warns of that your son has this talent and he's using it to bring an outsider in. So it's that I feel like this house fears people with the shining in a way. That was an interpretation I kind of came across watching it today. There were just some lines that really stuck out to me that didn't always. I think that's something that's so great about this film, is that there is so much going on in the house, and there is so much in there that's symbolic. And I mean, that's very Kubrick in itself, but absolutely the way the house works. And I will try to contain my excitement and fandom over Haunting of Hill House, because I love it so much. but it's that I completely agree with you on how the house is used as a character. It's done to incredible effect in this film.
Speaking of the ghosts too, you know, we basically have four main ones, and I'm counting the twins as one, just because the two of them are always together, and they might as well be one entity, so to speak.
Yeah.
But you have Grady, his daughters, Lloyd, and then you have the young and old woman in the bathtub, the one that tries to harm Danny because he's not really playing along like Jack is, mm-hmm. pretty much. But the daughters sort of just keep inviting Danny to come play with them. And they mention, you know, something to the effect of, "You can come play with us forever." And even though Danny is so young, he has something click to where he's like, "No, you know what? That doesn't sound right. So I am going to just stand here and wait for you to go away, or sit on my bike and wait for you to go away." So it's very interesting how quickly Danny catches on to what's going on in the hotel, because...
Well, that's a bit of help from Dick Halloran as well. I want to say that's dove into more in the book. Obviously, the book is very long, but I think it's a point of mention in the movie as well, where he like says something to him like, "They're just like a flicker in time or something." And he did, you know, "You just shut your eyes and just, you know, wait for them to go away." So it's like, it's because he was able to gain this kind of quick trust with Dick because of the conversation that they have about The Shining, which is a fantastic scene between the two of them. I feel like he had this extra support and almost a leg up in kind of like a quick training on how to deal with the house in simple ways, whereas Jack was left open, you know, completely vulnerable, because he doesn't have the intuition that someone like Danny has, and then an extended intuition because of his interaction with Dick.
Dick also tells him not to go into room 237 specifically. Right. And of course, when you tell that to a kid, they're probably going to turn around and go do that anyway.
Yeah.
And I like that Danny refrains from doing that the first time. Like you mentioned, he is on his bike and he stops right by the room and he stares at the door.
Yeah.
And he ultimately, you know, just continues on his bike and doesn't go in. But then once he sees the door open, he's like, "Oh, okay, that's sort of, you know, my invitation to go check it out." Mm-hmm. Clearly it someone's already in there. And, you know, he probably thinks one of his parents are in there. So it would be reasonable for him to check it out and go in, because the key is still on the door as well. But then he finds this woman in the bathtub, and when Jack goes in there later to check it out, he obviously sees the younger version of the lady at first. And, you know, other shows and movies have done something similar in the Murder House season of American Horror Story. They have the older lady who is taking care of the house, the cleaning lady, basically. And then all of a sudden she's younger when the husband sees her and everything like that. So you have moments like that that have sort of been a staple throughout various horror movies and shows that I think, you know, really sticks with people. But here it's used in such a different way too, because it's not just the fact that Jack sees the younger version, it's the fact that whichever lady was in the bathtub when Danny went in there actually tried to harm him. And Jack doesn't really care about that once he goes in there and sees who's in there.
Right. And it's I think it's really great how when Danny walks in, like, that's the last we see. We don't see what happens when Danny's in the room.
Right.
And then when he comes out, we see that, you know, he has marks on his neck. And this is immediately after Wendy has just woken Jack up from this horrifying nightmare that he says, you know, it was horrible. It was the worst nightmare he's ever had. And, you know, he was murdering her and Danny. And so after he's had this, you know, nightmare, and then she sees that, you know, Danny's been harmed, and the past that Jack had where he swears it was an accident that he broke Danny's arm, she has now, you know, snapped at him and said, I can't believe you hurt him, and to stay away from him and everything. So he's already kind of, you know, all this happens right after he's been startled out of this horrific dream. And now he's kind of, I feel like he's still in a daze and just kind of like, what the hell just happened? And now he's just wandering through the hall, and he's going and he's checking on the room, because Wendy, you know, came and freaked out and said there was another woman in the house. But he even just, as he walks in, he's just very, there's no sense of urgency when he's walking in the room. There's no like, oh my gosh, is there someone in the hotel? He's just very much being lured throughout this building. And yeah, then he walks into the room, and, you know, of course he's in an utter daze, and then ends up, you know, seeing her in the mirror, and
right.
And she's trying to grab him and everything. But it is interesting, like you said, how like the one that Danny saw clearly, you know, immediately harmed Danny. But I'm not so sure the room is trying to harm Jack, because they're trying to get the hotel is trying to get Jack to kill the family. And so the hotel is not going to take him out before that can happen.
It's trying to give him what he wants, basically, because, you know, he yeah. sees the more attractive younger lady get out of the bathtub and starts mm-hmm. making out with her. But then he looks in the mirror and sees the reality of what the lady looks right. like, and it's gross. So yeah. you know, she has like rotting flesh and everything like yeah. that. But it's not the first time that he's tricked into thinking he's doing something he's actually not, because we see that when he goes to the bar and he's talking Lloyd. To Lloyd.
Love
because
Lloyd.
You know, they're told on closing day that they take all of the alcohol out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But then he goes to the bar and suddenly sees Lloyd and all this alcohol that couldn't possibly be there.
Right.
And it's like, you know, part of him should realize that, but he just wants to drink so he doesn't realize it. And the fact that he thinks he's drinking when he's really not sort of fuels some of his anger too throughout, you know, sort of that point on in the movie. And I think it's really nicely done how he's so engrossed in the hotel that he doesn't even realize all of these things are happening that aren't actually supposed to be happening.
Right. Yeah, it's just that as the film goes on, he just becomes more and more attached to the hotel. The hotel has sunk its teeth into him. You know, even a scene that stood out to me watching today was when Danny goes to get his toy truck, and Jack is supposed to have just gone to sleep, but he's just sitting up in the bed, clearly awake, very exhausted looking, just drained and, you know, a little manic, and sits and has this conversation with Danny, and his neck is very red in that scene. And I don't know if it's just, you know, Jack Nicholson, or if it was an intentional kind of subtlety of the hotel, like,
right,
strangling him, you know, it's, and, you know, having their hold on him. It could just be him, because I tried to look and see if he had just a red neck later, and it seemed like it, but I don't know. It just seemed very, the way Stanley Kubrick shoots, I felt like it might have been a little bit of a subtle hint of the hotel's power, and as he falls deeper and deeper into madness. But I could just be, you know, saying nonsense.
He does kind of go in and out of it, though, because when we see him talking to Grady in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that line earlier where he says, you know, you've always been the caretaker, I've always been here. Jack starts to question him. He's like, no, you killed your family. So he is, yeah, in that moment, at least, aware that he's seeing someone he shouldn't be seeing.
Yeah.
He's like, I know for a fact that you are dead. Whereas with Lloyd, he doesn't really know that. And with the, yeah, young, attractive woman, I don't know what he was thinking in that moment. But, you know, who could have snuck onto the hotel property without him noticing and going up and getting a key to a room and, you know, yeah, running a bath and everything like that?
Yeah, and even I noticed after that scene, you know, he's freaking out and fleeing the room and everything. But when he goes back to Wendy and she's like, well, did you find anything? He's like, no.
Right.
No, everything's fine. There was nothing. Like, completely unfazed. And I'm like, is he just trying to, you know, is he in complete denial of what he saw? Is he purposely lying to, you know, to keep her from being freaked out, or, you know, guilt about what just happened? I feel like it could maybe be a mix of everything, but it's interesting how he was completely, like, horrified in that moment. But then when he's back, it's just like completely snapped to normalcy, as if nothing happened. And maybe it's the power of the hotel that maybe it's controlling his memory and emotion in that way, and only seeding him the madness when they need it, and then pulling it back when. Because I think at that point, Wendy has already wanted to get Danny out of the hotel, and Jack freaked out about that idea and completely, you know, shuts it down. And that's clearly, you know, his manic behavior with the hotel. You know, it's if Danny and Wendy get out of there, he can't kill them. And so it's interesting, as you said, he kind of has these ups and downs and snaps back into it and is completely aware of what's going on, and then in other moments just seems like he has no idea and hasn't experienced anything.
Yeah, one of the last things I want to talk about here before we get into final thoughts and everything are the differences from the book, because, you know, the final maybe 20-30 minutes of the movie veer a lot from how the book ends, and yeah. It's one of those things where, you know, they added in the Grady daughters and they weren't part of the book, which is still very confusing to me. But it's one of those things where you're like, oh, you have to sit back and think about the fact that they became so iconic because of the movie, not because they were part of the book. And, you know, obviously, oh, yeah, Stephen King has his issues with this movie because it doesn't follow the book quite as well as he was hoping, which is why we then have a different Shining years later, which, yeah, will be talked about at some point down the line on this podcast. It's quite a big gap between the two, though. But
yeah, I haven't seen that one yet.
I haven't either. I just bought it, though. So it will happen eventually.
Nice. Yeah, it's interesting. Like he said, with the twins, like even after reading the book, like, it is hard to separate the two because it just feels like they should be a part of it. Because I read the book, I want to say last year, and I remember even shortly after reading it, it had maybe only been like a couple weeks or something, and someone was saying to me, like, oh, how is the book? You know, is it really similar to the movie or is it different? And I remember in talking about it, I was sitting there and I was just like, I started talking about, yeah, the twin scene, you know, that's in there somewhere. And then I was like, wait, no, is it in there? It's like, so like weeks after reading the book, I still had it mixed up in my head because it feels right for it to be in there. And so I'm like, I swear it was in the book. But then it's when you look it up later, it's not there at all. It always gets me. And I kind of forgot about that until you mentioned it today too. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. It's not in the book.
I only remembered because I totally messed that up in the other podcast. Hopefully I would have edited it out, but we'll see. You know, it's one of those things where I'm kind of recording some of these out of order, so everything gets a little confusing. But, you know, by now everyone has heard the episode on the book, so they'll be able to confirm or deny anything I just said. But the end takes a drastic turn as well, because you have Dick Halloran still coming back to check on Danny and Wendy, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the book, you have all of these, you know, bushes in the shapes of animals and everything, you know, that's part of the scenery. Yeah. And those come to life in the book.
Yeah, I think that was a budgetary thing in 1980 of, you know, making them move.
Right.
I think that between that and I think in the book, the hotel blows up.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that was probably a large budgetary concern as well.
Yeah. So you have these big differences, and obviously you don't necessarily want to CGI a bunch of stuff in 1980 anyway, because one, it's probably way more expensive then because the technology just wasn't as advanced as it is now. Not that it's cheap now by any means, but
right,
like you said, it was probably more of a monetary thing. And the only thing that I didn't really agree with in the movie is the fact that Jack just takes an axe to Dick, because he has such a different role at the end of the book, because you have the epilogue where he took a job in Maine and, you know, still checks in on Wendy and Danny as they, you know, recover from injuries and things like that, just from trying to escape from Jack. So he has this sort of caretaker role himself in the end. And here we don't really get that because Jack just shoves an axe in his chest.
Oh man, the way that's shot is just like, you get that full on close up of the axe in his heart, and then it's intercutting with Danny's just like blood curling scream that is also alerting Jack to the fact that he is still in the house. And it's all those things happening with the quick cuts of the action that just occurred and the music pounding. It's brutal. And that I definitely agree with you. It's done very impactfully in the movie, but knowing the alternate take on it from the book, I do agree with you. I prefer when, you know, Dick lives instead of getting brutally murdered and quickly. Like, he doesn't even get to help at all. But he helps quite a decent amount in the book, helping them get out.
Yeah, absolutely. I do like that final shot where they're zooming in on the picture though, and you see that Jack had been there in 1921, which is, you know, years and years before this is taking place.
Yeah.
So you do have that nice moment at the end there where, you know, really he has always been the caretaker there.
Yeah.
And it's sort of one of those things that just kind of messes with your head. You're like, but wait, how would he not know this?
I know. And I was trying to think about, I was thinking about trying to look up maybe one of those, like, the ending of The Shining Explained, you know, right, videos, yeah, to see if someone had, you know, some crazy theory. Cause I was just like, I know there's probably been some debate over that. That's like an Inception type ending of just like, wait, but if he was there that time and now then he's like in the present. And, but it's such a great final shot. And I mean, even though the chase through the hedge maze and everything is not the same as in the book, I quite like that as a set piece, and how you cut from them escaping and then you have just that quick shot from him in the nighttime to then he's just frozen, and then the way they just subtly, you know, fade from him frozen to death to the painting with that, you know, really beautiful piece of music, you know, playing over it, and just the slow zoom, and then that's it. It's really a fantastic ending. The whole third act, you know, the way it ramps up is incredible. When Wendy's running through the hotel and she's now seeing the ghosts and everything, and sees all the skeletons like in the ballroom, which we've been seeing through the movie. Jack has seen these people completely, you know, lively and having a great time, as if they're really there. You know, the way it flips all this beauty that we've seen, and now it's just all the horror. Even Grady with like the axe mark like through his face. You know, it's really fantastic. There's so many good sequences in this movie, and I'm sure we didn't even like cover some of them, but it's like so hard to really remember it all, even having watched it today, because it's a lot to take in, but I love it.
Plus, like I said earlier, it's a movie that's over 2 hours long, and yeah. Some of these Stephen King adaptations I've noticed get very, very long. Like I just watched the Salem's Lot two-part TV series from 1979, and it was a total of like 3 hours of stuff to watch. Yeah.
That was my introduction to Stephen King as a kid. I think I may have been like 8 years old.
Yeah, there are some very big differences just between, you know, how this was shot in 1980 versus that in 1979. But again, that was, you know,
TV budget.
Yeah. And I
not
believe
Stanley Kubrick.
Right. Yeah. Hard to top that there. But I believe the 1997 Shining is a two-part TV series possibly as well. It's very strange.
I've heard it's good.
Because, you know, a lot of these adaptations, especially the older ones, did come out on, you know, TV budgets and everything like that.
Yeah,
so you have
a lot of them are TV miniseries.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, wow, I didn't realize so many of them were like this. But then you have the ones like this that are, you know, the actual theatrical releases and everything. And you have huge names in them like Jack Nicholson. And obviously he's like the biggest name in this movie. It seems like a lot of the other people in this didn't do too terribly much after this. Like, I don't know what the Grady twins did, because they don't even have pictures on IMDb or anything like that, you know?
They do have a Twitter now.
Okay.
And not that long ago, they were at the Stanley Hotel and they took a photo of them. They got a photo of them in the hallway.
Nice.
Standing next to each other. And then I flipped through their Twitter and it looks like they've done it in a number of other hotels. So it seems like a fun way to give themselves a little bit of a social media presence, even though, I don't believe they did much after.
Yeah.
But I thought that was funny. So definitely look up the Grady twins Twitter. It's a good time.
I will definitely have to check that out. We'll link to it in the show notes too. But do you have any final thoughts on The Shining? Like I said, you know, for me, this is a really great horror movie, regardless of how closely
Absolutely.
It does or does not follow the book at times. And, you know, like I said, I do see why Stephen King had some issues with it, especially being the one who wrote the source material. And I think that's something that can be hard for some people to get over. And obviously, this was still fairly early on in his career, too. You know, I think when you have something like we mentioned, The Haunting of Hill House earlier, that is way different than the book. You know, they're not even a family in the book. So it's one of those things where if it's done really well, I think people don't mind when it strays from the book. At least that's how I feel about this movie. But I get how it can be hard for the original creators to sort of let go of that a little more.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm the same way. It's for me, and I have not always been this way, and still to this day, you know, probably slip and have a more, you know, stuck opinion on something. But I try to be very open about adaptations, that it's just like, it is another take. And the way I try to look at it is, as long as you keep the heart and soul of what the book is, if you're giving me a different take and you're making different decisions, but overall you're still giving me a similar yet different experience with that, that can be really exciting. And I think that's one thing that this movie does. I think it's one thing that Haunting of Hill House does. Like, it gives you a very different take, but I think it still gives you, you know, that same, you know, heart and terror of the book, even with a different take on the story. And this movie, you know, it's iconic, it's legendary, it's historical, like it's forever going to be on the top list of horror, and it is well deserved. There's very few people I've come across that, you know, will outright say they don't like this movie. You know, even people I know who can't stand horror, like this one jumps out to them. It's such a great story. You know, it's the way it's shot is fantastic. One of the scenes we didn't mention before, that's one of my favorites, is when Wendy finds his papers.
Right. Yes. So great.
Oh, and he comes in and everything she's saying, the way he cuts from just a full-on shot on Wendy to cuts back to Jack, and he's just mocking everything she says. And then as he's slowly, you know, backing her up, you know, up the stairs, and he's just like, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to hurt you. It's just, oh, it's just prime Jack Nicholson. And from then on, it's just all that slow build we had, all the symbolism that we had, all the quick shots of, you know, the blood in the elevators and the twins, everything comes to a head in that final act. And it's done so brilliantly. We mentioned it a little earlier that, you know, one of the weaker parts of the film, I think, is Shelley Duvall's performance. It just kind of feels a little out of place, but it doesn't take me really out of the film. It doesn't pull things away. You know, she's still, even if it's a little over the top at times, I'm still engrossed in the horror that she's experiencing because Jack Nicholson's performance is so believable and terrifying. And
right.
So it's, yeah, I mean, I could go on. I will say a fun little fact, because we've mentioned Haunting of Hill House a few times, like during this. Mike Flanagan, who directed that, is directing the Dr. Sleep adaptation, which right. is the sequel to The Shining. And I imagine, I think from what I read, that's going to be more a sequel to The Shining, the book, than it is The Shining, the Stanley Kubrick adaptation, which I think could be interesting how that plays with audiences, depending yeah. on how many are familiar with the book versus this. But either way, Mike Flanagan and Ewan McGregor, I'm on board.
They just announced some new casting for it too. They have Jacob Tremblay in it, and it looks like he might be playing a young Danny in flashbacks, but that hasn't okay. been confirmed yet, so don't quote me on that by any means. So
that could be a good way to kind of allow audiences to see the film without having seen the Shining or read the book.
Yeah, I have not read Dr. Sleep just yet, but it is obviously on my list of things to do for this podcast. Yeah. And because we're recording this so early, you know, some of this news is going to be a little out of date here, you know. I think what it's probably January by the time you are all hearing this. So, you know, we might know who Jacob Tremblay is for sure playing by now. So it's,
they'll be shouting at the radio in their cars. Like, yeah. How could you not know?
What are you guys doing? Yeah. So just a heads up, this was recorded very early. It is November now. But Tim, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this. Like you said, we probably could just keep going and going if we wanted to break this down scene by scene or something. I feel like we'd have to have it on in the background and just go over every single shot
yeah,
in it.
Just like an ongoing commentary.
That it would take, like, you know, 3-4 hours by the time we actually finished it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's so good. And I mean, if people haven't seen it, go watch it.
And apologies and for spoiling everything.
And if you listen this far
movie.
To hear me say that, then why did you listen to this whole thing before watching it?
Yeah. Well, this has certainly been fun. And if anyone wants to follow us on Twitter or Instagram, we're at Chat Cemetery on there. I'll be posting updates of what I'm reading, what I'm watching, you know, things like that on the Instagram and everything. So definitely check us out there. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We're available through Apple, through Google, probably a few more. You can listen to it on YouTube. I'm trying to get everything covered here with this one. So anyone can listen to it anywhere, pretty much. But most importantly, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.